A glance at some of these letters, which will give you an awful lot of information.
Good, we will do that.
And I will tell you, I never let this book out of my sight. It's a valuable book to me, but not to anybody else.
I understand.
But if you both promise that you will see to it that it's returned, then you can go over it, you know.
What we might also do is make photocopies, but we can do that at a later date. Let's let Edris start right now.
Yeah, I'm talking about it.
Fine.
Okay. You know, once we've done questions today, then we can go back and look at some of this information.
Okay. Go ahead, you can begin.
This is for you. You're not going to take notes on this?
I'm just going to take them here. Go ahead.
Okay. Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Edris Wise interviewing Benjamin Perlow, November 7, 1983. Dr. Perlow, I'd like to ask you some questions about your immediate family. Can you tell me a little bit about your father and your mother?
I come from Brooklyn originally. To go to Pittsburgh, to Pitt. And briefly, I came, I saw my wife, and I conquered. It's the best way I can put it.
Were your parents originally from America? Your
no,
parents?
No, Russia.
Your parents were from Russia?
From Russia. From Vilna.
Both your father and your mother?
Both my father and mother.
And how many years did they live there before they came to the United States?
How many years did they live in Russia before they came to the United States? Well, they were both born in Vilna. Then they were married, and they lived in Vilna for about 3 years before they migrated to this country.
Did you have any sisters or brothers?
Oh, yes.
Born in Russia?
Yes, I had two. One I knew, the older sister died in Russia.
And what was her name?
And you ask me a question that I can't answer. I never knew her.
You have another sister?
Oh yeah, the oldest one who was brought here as a little girl, her name was Jenny. She grew up in Brooklyn. And she died about 12 years ago. I had two other sisters. One was named Ida, and she died in 1932. Mm-hmm. And my younger sister is named Betty, and she now lives down in North Miami Beach.
Do you have nieces and nephews?
Yeah, if you ask me where they are, I can't
tell
you.
They're all over.
I have nieces and nephews. They're all in the East. They all stayed in the East. Some of them in New Jersey, some of them in New York, but we drifted apart.
What profession did your father follow?
He was a tailor.
Mm-hmm.
Like all Russian Jews.
Mm-hmm. And this is what he did when he came to the United States?
Well, this is what he started in. In Russia, he was a farmer and learned enough in Hebrew to be a rabbi, but he didn't want to be a rabbi. And so he went to work in a factory,
mm-hmm.
in a clothes factory.
Did he come to the United States on his own, or did somebody send for him?
No. He came on his own, but he was the oldest, and then he brought a lot of nieces and nephews of his that are scattered all through the East. You see, he was the youngest of 16 children.
Wow.
And he was the youngest of 16 children.
They were all alive?
Well, I don't know.
Nobody, as far as you know, nobody died in childbirth or anything?
No, not that I know of. But when he came here, he started to bring nieces and nephews over. and they lived at our place, and then he found jobs for them, and they went out on their own. You know, that was the history of every immigrant family.
That's right.
That they came when they came in.
But none of his sisters or brothers came to the United States?
None of his sisters or brothers. An interesting thing, I'll take a minute to tell you this. It's interesting. His oldest brother was a Nikolayische Soldat. Do you know what that means?
No.
A Tsar's soldier. And by the expression, that ceased to exist over 100 years ago. But actually what it means is young babies, practically, males, were taken from their homes into the army, and the army raised them to be servants to the officers in the Tsar's army. And they were called Nikolayische Soldaten, soldiers
of
the Tsar,
of
Nicholas.
Tsar, yeah.
His oldest brother was one of those. And his oldest brother, when he grew up, and of course all of these, no matter where they came from, they were all raised in the Greek, in the Russian Orthodox Church. Well, my father's oldest brother was converted as a child, but it didn't make any difference to the rest of the family. He was converted, and he was the equivalent of swine. See?
Mm-hmm.
And this was true of all Orthodox Jews. He got out of the army, and he married a very wealthy girl. And of course, he was a member of the Russian Orthodox Church. He married a girl whose father had a furniture factory in Caucasia. And that was on the Turkish border. And Caucasia was the town that, the name will come to me in a minute. In 1913, when my father came to America, the last week he was at home, his oldest brother walked into the house. It took him 3 days to get there from Caucasia. They lived in Vilna. My father was getting ready to leave. And when he walked into the house and told my father who he was, my father would have nothing to do with him. He turned his back on him because he was converted, you know. And he said to my mother told me this, he said to my mother, I expected a better reception than this. I traveled 3 days to find out who in my family was left. And this is the reception I get. And he said to my mother, while your husband is gone, you see, my father came first and got settled here. While he's gone, if you need anything, get in touch with me, and I'll see that you get it. He became a very wealthy furniture manufacturer. Actually, he didn't start a business. His wife inherited this furniture plant from her father, and he stepped into it. And so that's the last my father heard, and that's the last that my mother heard. But the last thing my father said to my mother, don't you dare get in touch with him. I forbid it. So, of course, my mother didn't get in touch with him, and then he was... I don't know how many thousand miles away from Vilna. Caucasia is on the Turkish border.
Was this in 1913?
No, this was about 1889 when my father came to America. In 1913, my father received a letter from the oldest son, Vladimir Perlov. And in this letter, he said, after much inquiry, he discovered he had an uncle in America. And so he wrote to my father. How he got the address, I don't know, and none of us ever knew. But he wrote to my father, and he told my father that he wants to come to America. He and his three brothers and his sister and her husband, and they're all graduates of the University of Vienna, and they want to come to this country. And when they come here, they will have about $750,000 in American money, besides leaving enough for the mother to take care of herself. She didn't want to leave her husband's grave.
You know, this is the oldest brother, then, who had passed away in the meantime. Your
this was
father's
his
oldest
children.
Brother?
His children.
Hmm? Your father's oldest brother then had died in the meantime, and these are his children.
Yeah, he was killed.
Yeah.
He explained in his letter that his father was shot and killed by one of the peasants working in the factory. And the peasant only got 6 months in jail because his defense was he discovered that his father had Jewish blood and he was living in a town that was forbidden to Jews. So in violation of that, he shot and killed him. That was the defense. So he only got 6 months. But because of the revelation that there was Jewish blood, he explained that he and his brothers and sister can't go on living in Russia anymore because they mingled with the money set.
Mm-hmm.
So my father, who never saw more than a $20 bill, didn't know what to tell him. So, you know, in all these families, they started to have conferences every Sunday on what to do. And my father was afraid that they must be accustomed to everything good. And if they come to this country before they get settled, they'll spend so much and so much of their money. And I remember a cousin of mine who, I remind his daughter, who was a judge in New York, and very prominent in law circles in New York, I reminded her of her father was a brilliant man, and he said, "Oh, Uncle, don't be so foolish. Tell them to come. They'll get along." So every Sunday they held meetings at the house. They came to the house and they held meetings until 1914 and the war broke out. And that section of Caucasia was immediately overrun by the Turkish army. So we assumed from that they were all wiped out. And it wasn't until 1939 you weren't old enough to know this, but the German army started marching into Poland and on the Labor Day weekend of 1939. But they started marching on Sunday. On Saturday, my sister, who now lives in Florida, was coming back from California. And she and I were sitting in the living room and they were breaking in with news flashes then, you know, on the radio. And they announced, "We have just had a flash. Vladimir Perlow and his staff, the new ambassador to Berlin, the new Russian ambassador to Berlin, has arrived in Berlin with his staff. And it is expected that this will be the signal for the German armies to start marching." And they did. They started to march. He arrived on Saturday. He started to march on Sunday. And then they gave a brief history of Vladimir Perlow, and it said he was educated at the University of Vienna, and he was a linguist, and he was the private interpreter to Molotov. And so, you know, I didn't know what his connection was, but when he was a graduate of the University of Vienna, I assumed he was the one. When Khrushchev, we never heard any more about him. When Khrushchev arrived in this country, I asked my cousin in New York, who's an attorney, and was pretty high up in Democratic circles. She was very close to Wagner, and she was the private, and she was the law secretary to Mayor LaGuardia.
What was her name?
Perlow, same as mine. Florence Perlow. And she's an elegant looking individual. And I told her to ask Khrushchev. She was on the reception committee. I told her to ask Khrushchev what happened to her cousin, Vladimir Perlow.
I'll take that.
And that was written up in the New Yorker magazine. And the answer that Khrushchev gave her, he never heard the name. He's not acquainted with anybody by that name. Then she asked Mrs. Khrushchev the same question. They never heard the name. Well, the story there was that in Russia, it was an offense to be connected or to be a friend of somebody who was in bad repute, you know, with the government. So they never heard the name. And
how many years after your father came to this country did your mother come?
Just about 1 year. Just about 1 year.
And they came right to Pittsburgh? Or
no,
they came to Brooklyn. How did they happen to go there?
To Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
Every Jew went to Brooklyn.
That was where the boat stopped.
Every Jew went to Brooklyn. I'm trying to find a picture here that I wanted to show you. Oh, wait. And when I was married, my father came to Pittsburgh, and the trip was so long, he and my mother both had to get off in Harrisburg and take another train. It was just too much for them. And the first thing my father said to me when he arrived in Pittsburgh was, "I never knew that America's so big." This is my cousin who's an attorney.
She's beautiful.
And the woman next to her
it's Mrs. Martin Revson.
Yeah, she
oh,
she
from
was
Revlon.
Yeah, she was the wife of the owner of Revco. When that picture appeared in the New York Times, I called her up just to kid her, and I said, "I just got through talking to Mrs. Revson." She says, "How did you get to talk to Mrs. Revson?" I said, "I called her." She said, "What'd you call her for?" I said, "I congratulated her on getting her picture next to yours." That made a hit with her. Well, I get off the subject.
No, it's wonderful.
That's just the kind of stories
that we want. It's true.
All right, your parents came to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Where did they live in Brooklyn? What type of a home was it?
It was in the Bronzeville section of Brooklyn, which was about, Brooklyn had about Brownsville had about 400,000 people in it. That was the population. And we used to say we had 399,900 Jews and 100 Gentiles. And they were the Shabbos Goyim. And that's the story that made the round there. That's what they used to say. Whenever you saw a Gentile, say, well, the only thing he does, he lights the candles. I'll tell you an interesting story about my mother. When she came...
Excuse me for interrupting. What was her name?
Hmm?
What was your mother's name?
Dora. When she was in the kitchen one day, and the door opened up, and the character in that neighborhood ran in. He was an Irish fella, and he was drunk most of the time. And his name was Crane. And everybody knew Crane. He was a troublemaker there. He ran in, and he ran into a cupboard. And right after him came a policeman. And the policeman said, "Did Crane run in here?" And my mother, who was afraid to say yes, she said, "No, no." And she pointed to the cupboard. So she says, he walked over and got him by the neck and dragged him out. But she felt safe.
Right. That was a smart way to do it. You were brought up in a very Orthodox home then. Was this a house you lived in or an apartment?
For a long time, we lived in an apartment. Apartment is the wrong word. In a tenement house. Mm-hmm. They were all tenements. And you lived on the first or the second floor, front, left, or something like that, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
And then, when I was quite grown up, I got out of high school, my mother bought a small house. And we lived in that house.
Was your father living at the time?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What was your father's name and your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Spitalnikov. Spitalnikov. My father's first name was Harris. Harris Perlow.
Do you remember any of the kinds of discipline that you received growing up? Was your mother or were your parents strict disciplinarians?
Every family in that section, they were all strict disciplinarians. The father, just like in Russia, was still the head of the house, and his word was law. And what he said was said, and that's the way you acted.
Were you exposed to cultural things in those days? Music?
Just the study of Hebrew. Any cultural things that I got at a settlement house that was debating elocution and so on. I never went in for music. We did have a piano at the house, and an older brother started to take lessons, and he wasn't interested in the thing, so my mother decided that I wouldn't be either. And she was probably right. So I married a pianist.
What interesting and outstanding things can you remember about growing up in Brooklyn? Going to school, your friends?
Yes. the school, the great school, I can give you... When I went to grade school, I used to stammer, and I was a very bad stammerer. And in the in what is the fifth year here was the fifth year there, except here it's 5B, 5A. Over there it was 5A and 5B. And for a whole year, the teachers couldn't decide on whether to let me continue in public school or send me to a school for the dumb. And the actual story was that when I would get up to recite, I'd open my mouth, and instead of a word coming out, I would take a step forward. Then I'd try again, and I'd take another step forward. And before I was through, I was up front, and the teacher would say, all right, write it on the board, you know, the answer. In the 7A, I had a mathematics teacher who was really a wonder. We used to call it arithmetic then, but he was, if I had the money, I'd order a statue made for him, and I'd place it in a prominent place. Isidore Springer. He told the principal that he thought he could cure me of stammering if everybody else in the school would follow his instructions. So his instructions were, and I used to meet him in the library every Saturday morning, and I would read to him. And it was very simple. He'd have me start, and I had to take a deep breath. And when I got to the top of my breath and started to exhale, that's when my first word was to come out. And then I'd continue until I'd stop and I'd get to the end of a sentence. And the explanation that he gave me, I will never forget. He said, when people are sick and they moan and they groan, it's always on the exhale. And that's true. If you think of somebody that's sick,
right.
See? And he said, because it takes no effort for that. So he used to have me read, and when I'd come to the end of a sentence, before I start another sentence, he'd say, take a deep breath. Now, when I start to exhale. And he cured me of stammering. The instructions to all the teachers were that when they called on me, you know, we had a departmental system, they were to see that I took a deep breath before I started to talk. Now, those were his only instructions to me. And then when I started in high school, I had a history teacher. The only way we referred to him was, he was a son of a bee. He would recite all period, and 5 minutes before the period was up, we'd get a warning bell. That's when he would start to get in some recitations. And I remember he spoke with a nasal twang. He'd say, Parlon. So I'd stand up. What can you tell me about the War of 1488? So I started to take a deep breath. He'd say, sit down, zero. You know, so after that, when we were changing classes, I went up and told him that the experience I had. He said, yeah. Well, Dr. Springer isn't in the school. I'm running the history classes. So the very next period when we came in, Parlon, as soon as we came in, and he asked me a question, and of course I went through the same thing. Sit down, zero. And then he said, now that Parlon is not recited, we'll go on with the lesson. Well, this went on for a couple of weeks. Then I went down and saw the principal. And I explained to the principal, who was a very fine man, what had happened when I was in grade school. I'm telling you this because if you know anybody that stammers, this is an easy cure. And I told him, he said to me, well, I know Dr. Springer, he's now the principal of so-and-so, and I'll be in touch with him. And if what you tell me is correct, you'll get enough time to recite. So, a few days later, the clerk came up from the office and said, Dr. James wants to see Mr. Brummer and Perlow.